Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Greenwashing is defined as deceptive advertising or marketing that claims a product is good for the environment when it really isn't. New federal legislation will attempt to clamp down on that, since it can be hard for consumers on their own to assess the claims of companies. Will the new law get the job done? Let's find out. In Gatineau, Quebec, we welcome Julien Beaulieu, competition lawyer and a lecturer at the Université de Sherbrooke. In the nation's capital, Keldon Bester, former special advisor at the Competition Bureau and executive director of CAMP, that's the Canadian Anti-Monopoly Project. And here in our studio, Tanya Yemitz, finance lawyer at the environmental law charity EcoJustice, and Phil DeLuna, who's a former sustainability expert at McKinsey & Company and chief carbon scientist at Deep Sky, that's a gigaton scale carbon removal project developer. And it's great to have you two here in our studio. And to our friends in Points Beyond, thanks for joining us on TVO tonight. Keldon, going to put you to work first. How much confidence do you have in the current Competition Bureau's ability to reduce this phenomenon of greenwashing?
Well, it's an interesting period of time. We've had a couple of cases that have gone after a relatively narrow definition of greenwashing, but now we're seeing complaints, I'm sure we'll discuss more, that look at a broader definition, more about claims, overall business models, or a brand entirely. So it's really uncharted waters, I think. There have been some successes in the past, but they've been fairly narrowly defined. So I'm interested to see how these broader claims do under our current law.
We will dive into all of this. Julien, how about you? How much confidence do you have in the Competition Bureau's ability to do something about this?
I think it's their job. It's clearly in their mandate. Of course, they have limited resources. So the Competition Bureau does a lot of things. They do mergers. They investigate cartels, so all sorts of deceptive practices. They're really a watchdog that has a lot to do. But if it's not them, then who is it going to be? They're the only federal agency that can address greenwashing at a national level. They have experts. They have professional investigators, so we expect that they need to do it, because if they don't do it, then who else?
If not them, then who? Tanya, what do you think in terms of their ability to do this? Julie makes it sound like they got a lot on their plate already.
They do have a lot on their plate, but deceptive marketing is really important for, you know, protecting consumers, making sure we have a fair playing field. And I think that if the federal government can really help the Competition Bureau out by, you know, setting some laws and rules that they could then enforce, because that's what they do, and I think that they will do a great job of that.
Let me mix it up a bit with you here, Phil, which is, what do you think prompts companies to greenwash in the first place?
It's a great question. I mean, I think companies are starting to realize that sustainability is table stakes. A lot of people thought that it was going to be a passing fad. And if anything, since the pandemic, making sure that your business is sustainable has only increased in importance. And there is certainly a desire for some companies to show that they're doing something, and a temptation to take a shortcut, which is what greenwashing is. Becoming sustainable is very hard. It's costly, and it takes real work. And some folks want to reap the benefit without putting the work in.
But Tanya, presumably you do it because you think you will get away with it, right? Is that why they do it?
That could be a reason you could get away with it. Another reason could be that there's not enough rules and guidance, and maybe some companies just need a little bit more help. And that's where the Competition Bureau could step up. They could issue some greenwashing guidance that really sets some examples. We see that in other jurisdictions.
Julien, is that right? I shouldn't necessarily be so nefarious in my interpretation here. Maybe they just don't know the rules well enough. Is that possible?
That's possible. That's certainly possible. A lot of them have good intents. They want to do good. They want to tap in these new green markets. They want to attract consumers that are interested in sustainable products, whatever that means. So yes, a lot of them want to do it well. And Tanya raises a very good point. There needs to be guidance out there. We heard a lot of companies I've been doing some research on this topic for some time. And many times I heard companies saying, we want to do it well. We're interested in making genuine environmental claims. But what does green mean? If I want to say that I want to supply a green product, what does that mean? What's the bar? Which standards do I need to comply with? And that's really the challenge here. It's that there is legal uncertainty. The Bureau needs to step in and provide guidance. But of course, guidance is not everything. There also needs to be some very concrete laws that can address this phenomenon.
Right. Well, let's find out what's going on at the moment. Keldon, I gather there have been 8 complaints of greenwashing filed at the Competition Bureau over the past couple of years. So members of Parliament want to amend the Competition Act to stop this practice of greenwashing. But so far, I'm told the details are rather sketchy. What are they saying at the moment?
Well, what's been put forward in Bill C-59 is really a clarification. Deceptive marketing practices cases have been brought against greenwashing successfully before, but what C-59 does is it clarifies that greenwashing specifically should be considered a deceptive act. And that strengthens the hand of the Bureau when it goes to court to say, you know, there should be a objective test for this and, you know, it's not being met on a product or service. But what's interesting is that recent complaints have said it's not the claim about a product, it's about the claim of a company or brand entirely. And that really is where the ambiguity is. There hasn't been a case litigated where the question is not the claim of a product, but really an entire company.
Keldon, what do you think in terms of, or forgive me, let me go to Tanya on this. What do you think in terms of C-59 and whether it's got the ability to get it done?
So C-59, the greenwashing provision, is a good first step, but it's just inadequate to address the breadth of greenwashing that we're seeing in the market. C-59 focuses only on product greenwashing, and the majority of greenwashing we see is about brands, is about corporations.
Much bigger than just a product.
Much bigger than just a product. And so that's where the government really needs to step in and look at the market and see what is happening and make laws that then address that need.
Phil, what do you say?
I couldn't agree more. We're seeing this happening, for example, in the United States. The Securities and Exchange Commission is releasing legislation and regulations that if you're a publicly traded company, you have to disclose your emissions. You can't manage what you don't measure. That's the step one of any strategy. Right now, the bill, while it is a good first step, there is so much uncertainty around what counts and the definition that it's far, far inadequate.
Well, Julian, you see a lot of this, so tell me, what are the most common inappropriate claims that companies that greenwash make?
So the most popular categories. And then beware, when next time you go to the supermarket, you're going to see some of them, I'm sure. One big category is the generic claims. Companies using words like green or sustainable, responsible. These words are generic. We don't really know what they mean, so it's very difficult to measure them. So that's one big category of greenwashing. Another big category is selective disclosures. So essentially firms, organizations disclosing certain information about one aspect of their environmental impacts, but not disclosing corresponding impacts. So let's say you're going to claim that you're net zero greenhouse gas emission, but you're not going to say that to achieve this, you had to destroy biodiversity. You had to harm the environment in another way. So that's another way, selective disclosures. That's another very, very common one. Another very common form is just to say things that are false. So you're providing information that is not true, that is not based on science, that is not based on proper tests. Another category is also providing information that's just misleading. So you're going to say a thing that is theoretically not false, but that is not sufficiently comprehensive or clear to provide the full story.
Well, Tanya, I admit this next example I'm going to give might be a bit ridiculous, but I'm trying to get a better understanding of how, you know, where the boundaries are on this. There's a popular soap brand called Irish Spring. Mm-hmm. If you look at the bar, it's green. Can they say, we're promoting a green product here? In fact, it is the color green if you look at it.
Now, I think you'd have to put that in context, right? It's the general impression of what a consumer gets. I think just showing a green soap would not be enough, or saying, you know, we're promoting a green product. I think that you'd have to look at the interpretation of what green generally means to people. I think you see this a lot in car advertisements where you see beautiful, you know, scenery and landscapes and maybe some choice words that are, like Julian said, very vague, very generic, but you're talking about a combustion vehicle, right? And I think that's where sort of the rubber hits the road a bit more.
So, Phil, just so, again, clarify everything here. If you are an automobile manufacturer, and it's not an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. It's an internal combustion engine. Are there any circumstances within which you can say, this is a, given its class, a sustainable product or cares about the environment or something like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have to break down what the different scopes of emission are in order to answer that question. Scope 1, Scope 2, Scope 3. Scope 1 emissions are the emissions from producing that vehicle. It's the emissions on people actually making the car. Scope 2 emissions are the emissions from the electricity grid that produces that vehicle. So if you're producing an electric vehicle, you can't be 100% green if you're using a fossil fuel grid to power your plant. And then Scope 3 emissions are emissions that are indirectly associated, ways that, for example, if you're transporting that car elsewhere, the gas that gets combusted in that vehicle when it's being used. So the boundary with which you claim what is green or what is sustainable is very important. Could you say that, yes, our production is green? Well, if your production of your vehicle is on a renewable lot, you have solar on your roof and it's 100% renewable, you could technically claim that. But it would be misleading because the majority of the emissions come from the combustion of the gasoline when a consumer drives it.
Well, Keldon, yeah, let me get into this a little more because obviously this province is making a huge bet on electric vehicles. And I imagine we are going to see in the future a lot of advertisements that say these new EVs are fantastic for the environment because, of course, nothing comes out of the tailpipe. However, you know, if you tell the whole story, some of which Phil has just told, and in addition, these huge batteries in these EVs may be a little bit difficult to dispose of once the car's lifetime is over. How much can they push this narrative that these are, in fact, clean, green vehicles?
Well, I think the issue will really hinge on that word deception. You know, the Competition Bureau is not looking to be the arbiter of green claims. What it's really trying to reinforce is fair competition and, you know, faithful representations of what a product or a service represents. So what the Bureau will be focused on is the claims and the question of, you know, is there a test backing this up? Is there something we can point to say this is substantiated and it's responsible? That will necessarily involve some gray area cases. But the Bureau, I think, especially when it goes to truly investigate and then even more rare to litigate, it's looking for where there's a real act of deception going on and can pursue other means if it's more on the lines of a misunderstanding.
But Julian, how hard is it to prove deceptive intent?
So it can be very difficult. It's not necessarily something that's required under the... So to get into the details, there's two provisions. There's one provision in the Competition Act that's criminal, where you need to provide that there... You need to prove intent. But for the other provision, intent is not required. So as long as there's deception, then yeah, there might be a legal violation there. But it's still a difficult proof. The burden is not so easy to meet because you also need to prove that the general impression of the consumer was that this was green, and or you need to prove what was the general impression that was given to the consumer, and you also need to prove that the characteristic that we're talking about was a material point. So was it material for the consumer when they bought, let's say, a recycled plastic bottle? Was it material, the recyclability feature? Was it a material feature of the product? So that's one big challenge. How do you prove that something is material, and how do you prove that the general impression that the consumer gets when they are being advertised a green product is, let's say, net zero emissions or no harm to biodiversity. So these things are not so easy to prove.
Right.
However, just sending a clear signal to the marketplace that there's going to be increasing scrutiny, establishing clear guidelines, clear standards, you're already sending a clear message here. Like, we don't need to get into the litigation and the proof and going before the tribunals. As soon as you have a strong signal, then companies are going to adapt and they're going to change their behavior accordingly. And then we're going to get green markets that work, because that's really the core issue here. It's green markets, having stakeholders that can choose according to their environmental preferences. But right now, that's not what we're seeing in the Canadian marketplace.
Well, Tanya, let me ask you about the signals that are being sent to the market, because your group, EcoJustice, I mean, you're in the business of, well, I shouldn't say it, you should say it, but I presume you're in the business of suing people who don't adhere to the law.
yes, eco-justice does use the power of the law. So we do legal challenges, litigation. Some of the complaints that were mentioned already today were brought by eco-justice to the Competition Bureau. And we also do law reform. So we work on both sides of the coin there.
Okay, I raised this because I gather there was a coffee company not too long ago that was being a little fast and loose with the facts about their single-use cups. Mm-hmm. And they claimed these cups were recyclable.
Yeah.
And I gather they weren't. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
Okay, and they got fined a couple of $1 million as a result.
That's right, yeah.
Now, would a fine of $2 million, which to those of us sitting around this literal and metaphorical table sounds like a lot of money, but to a massive multinational might not be that much, is that enough to deter bad behavior?
So I think the administrative penalty fines, even if they're low, can have an impact on companies because surrounding that is media and public attention. And companies want to maintain a good reputation. They want to be seen as green, as you said, so they can compete in the market. And so while the administrative penalty might be a drop in the bucket for them, I think everything that comes around with it is also important. And hopefully the Competition Bureau, as they step into this role of deceptive marketing and greenwashing more and more, they can increase those fines. And there's different mechanisms that they can use, such as, you know, importing a fine that's three times the amount of the benefit that the company got, which can then really add up.
But do they really do that?
We haven't seen it yet.
But hope springs eternal?
Hope springs eternal.
There we go. Phil, okay, we found out about Tanya's job. Your job is to help companies transition to a greener way of doing business. When you sit down with them, how do you advise them to do that?
Yeah. I mean, again, the first step is understanding what your emissions baseline are. That's the number one thing. There was a huge wave of companies that made net zero claims without really thinking about what that meant and defining what net zero actually is. So the second step is then setting interim targets and goals. There's an organization called the Science-Based Targets Initiative, SBTI. What they do is they help to validate private corporations and their claims and their goals towards net zero. A great step that a company can take is to go become SBTI certified, as another example. But then ultimately, it's the hard work. It's looking at your supply chain and understanding, can you do things better? Can you reduce waste? Can you implement new clean energies or new technologies? The way I think about sustainability and the way that I tell clients and customers, especially now at Deep Sky, sustainability isn't a sector or a fad or a thing onto itself. But rather, it's a lens that the entire economy will have to come through. Just like how there was a digital transformation, we went from analog to digital. We are now experiencing that same economic movement, going from fossil-based economy to a sustainable one. And if you do not act now, you are at risk.
Well, let me do an example here, and you tell me whether or not a company could make the claim that it's being net zero if, for example, they have a factory and there's lots of CO2 emissions that go up the stack. But let's say they plant a lot of trees. Let's say they plant 1 million trees. And so on balance, the trees soak up that carbon dioxide and they claim they're net zero. Are they?
That's a really tough question. And, you know, it's a $1 million question. I'll tell you why. They would like, of course, to say that they're net zero.
Right.
But the reality of the science is trees don't grow necessarily as fast as they are emitting. It takes 40 years for a tree to reach maturity. And over that time, when you plant a seedling, it's not removing 1,000 tons of CO2 per year already. It's a size and scale mismatch. So if a company is emitting CO2 from their flue stack and they try to offset it with nature-based solutions, there's been increasing amount of scrutiny on looking at whether these actually do the carbon removals that they say they will. Another example. Canada last year had the record in its history for forest fires. So even if you plant a tree, if a forest fire happens, that removal literally goes up in smoke. The CO2 that was removed will go back into the atmosphere. So there are issues with permanence, there's issues with additionality, with monitoring and verification. So if a large company is, an oil and gas company, for example, is saying that they're reducing all their emissions by planting trees, I would be very skeptical. You have to do technology-based solutions, which is what Deep Sky is doing, to really measure and match that scope.
Why is the company called Deep Sky?
Because we take carbon from the sky and we bury it deep underground.
There you go. Okay, Keldon, come in on this. We heard some solutions here for companies to ensure a green transition to getting carbon out of the way they do business. Give us some other solutions that are being looked at right now.
Well, you know, I come at things from a competition perspective, so that's going to color my response. You know, what the big part about deceptive marketing practices is rewarding and encouraging fair competition, which is to say that companies compete on the merits, and in this case, you know, the merits of these environmental claims, which, you know, as we saw in the Keurig case, you know, consumers are taking, you know, much more seriously. So again, what we push for is, you know, this notion of fair competition on the merits is one that encompasses a definition of, you know, environmental and sustainability goals, so that, as has been discussed, the companies that are putting the hard work in to actually be sustainable are rewarded, and that positive feedback loop, that competitive cycle, rewards those companies over those that might be either misleading or continuing on with unsustainable models.
Julian, can I get an example from you on, you don't have to name what the company is, but a kind of business that has decided to get serious about this and compare that with somebody who's greenwashing?
That's a very good example. I think net zero targets are certainly an area where it's easier to compare companies, and the SBTI, the Science Based Targets Initiative, is one of these initiatives that aims to look at all companies with identical reporting frameworks, and then you can really compare across sectors, across companies, which ones are doing the most efforts and are really performing and reducing their emissions. So this type of framework where you can actually compare using the same numbers, that's fantastic. And Canada is moving ahead with these climate disclosures for companies. So the federal government said that they were looking into it, looking at asking private companies to disclose their carbon emissions following very specific standards. That would be amazing. However, that would only be for greenhouse gas emissions, and that wouldn't solve greenwashing in its entirety, because we also need indicators for what's recycled, what's nature positive product, pollution, all sorts of pollution, water pollution. We need indicators for all of these indicators, and we need reporting practices that are standardized across the industry, so that we can actually pick and choose. It's very, very difficult. I honestly try it. Go to the supermarket and try to pick the products that are the greenest or the most sustainable. Very, very difficult. Requires a lot of time, a lot of energy. There are some private certifications out there, but what do they mean? Are they all credible? Very, very difficult. So it's very messy right now, the environment. The corporate environment is messy, which leads to a messy environment for the planet. So that's certainly an issue. But I agree that there are solutions. Right now, businesses can take action. They can be more careful. They can be more prudent. Under promising and over delivering is always a good business practice when we talk about representations. Avoiding cherry picking, making sure that they have evidence to back every claim, making sure that everything is grounded in science. These are very simple rules of thumbs that you can follow, and then you're going to stay out of trouble. And then Tanya won't sue you then, and complain against your company.
We don't want to deprive you of your opportunity to sue somebody if you already want to, Tanya. But
you know what? The best thing would be if we didn't have to exist.
There you go. Well, okay, while you've got the floor, let me ask you this. I'm going to take two letters from the expression greenwashing, mm-hmm. and I'm going to change them, because I've heard of this other thing called green hushing. What's that?
Well, green hushing is when companies are afraid to talk about the green efforts that they're doing because of, you know, litigation or complaints or bad media attention that could come up if, you know, there's questions about what they are doing.
Is green hushing a problem, Phil?
You know, it's interesting. When we think about the political landscape, especially in places like the United States, where you actually have some Republican-controlled legislatures in the states suing companies for having sustainable practices. So the other side of the spectrum, your mortal enemy. But, I can understand why a company would be hesitant in either direction, either claiming that they're green or avoiding to claim that they're green, until more understanding, regulation, more of the guidelines and rules have been defined. But ultimately, what people need to realize is that being green isn't just something that you say. It has a tangible impact on your business. It has a tangible impact on your costs, on your risks. As an insurance company, there are insurance companies that are leaving entire jurisdictions. You can't get housing insurance in some states that are close to water anymore because of risk of flooding. And that's just the first. We have to think about agriculture and the food systems that are at risk. We have to think about manufacturing and supply chains that are global at risk as well. So yes, we can talk about consumer-facing goods and what's green and what's not, but ultimately businesses will do what's important for their business, and sustainability is an incredibly important factor for them today.
Keldon, I presume, and you've said, this is a very complicated issue, and therefore, how do companies know if they're really being compliant with the rules, you know, doing it the way they should be doing it? How do they know?
Well, as it stands today, you know, ahead of C59 and even further proposed reforms, the real question is around this adequate test. You know, is the claim based on just a claim, or has the business related to a product or service undergone some sort of testing to see whether this claim actually holds up to some scrutiny? I mean, the part that is out of the control of the company in some ways is what was discussed earlier is, you know, is this a material part of the business? Do consumers choose a product because it's of its ecological perception, regardless of what the company does? So what I think the company needs to focus on is, if we are making a claim, what do we have to back that up? Have we actually invested the time and resources as opposed to, is this something we just stick on the package?
And just to be clear, there is ample evidence that consumers actually want to do the right thing. They want to buy green if it's really green, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, take the Keurig case in particular. I think it's a material difference if a product is recyclable or going to a landfill. That clearly was the case there. And I think in everyday conversation, we frequently come across folks making decisions based on the environmental impact. And that's where the intersection with competition and competition law comes. When something about a product or service becomes something people care about, that is now something you can compete on. And I think, you know, like other things like privacy protection, these things have really come to the fore in the past 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Julien, I always like to know who's doing this well. So can you tell us, point us to some other jurisdictions that are doing it well that we could learn from and maybe give an example of what they've done that we ought to take note of?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of examples. So that certainly we can certainly draw inspiration from a lot of jurisdictions. I would say Canada has not been at the forefront of this issue, unfortunately. Maybe we were ahead, like maybe 20 years ago. Unfortunately, others have caught up and have gone even beyond what we had in terms of legal framework. California is one jurisdiction that's ahead. They have something very interesting in their consumer protection law. When consumers make environmental claims, when companies do environmental claims, consumers have a right to request the materials that back these claims. So you can actually go to see the company and ask, hey, you said this was green. How come? Show me the materials. What do you have in the back office to prove this? So that's very interesting. We would love to see something similar in Canada, have this right to information. That would be very, very interesting. Europe has also been very aggressive on tackling greenwashing. They have prohibited certain words that are intrinsically misleading, like green or eco-friendly. They say these words should just never be used because they're always going to be misleading for consumers. And they've also required, they've set certain standards for private certification. So whenever a company wants to rely on a private environmental certification, it needs to meet a specific standard. France also has something interesting. They have a disclosure obligation. So whenever a company wants to say that a product is carbon neutral, they need to put a QR code on the product or a link to a website. And then you scan that at the supermarket. Again, you scan the product with your phone. You got the QR code and it brings you to a page that shows how the company came to the conclusion that the product was carbon neutral. There's emissions accounting there. There are specific standards that companies need to comply with. So you really receive very comprehensive information. And that empowers consumers to make proper decisions and also report cases to the enforcer. So when you see this type of information, you can go to the Consumer Protection Agency and say, hey, this doesn't look very comprehensive, or it doesn't look super realistic. Maybe you should investigate this company because it doesn't seem to be making truthful claims. So they're really empowering stakeholders to take action and ensuring that they have all the right information. That's certainly something we don't have right now, but Bill C-59 is a great opportunity. If it was slightly expanded, it would be a great opportunity to get similar protection.
So let's finish up on that then. Tanya, we've heard lots of examples there of others around the world who are putting a more muscular face on this policy. How hopeful are you that Canada will follow suit?
You know, I'm really hopeful. We see consumers really want to understand the products they're buying. We're at a point in time where we're, as a nation, as people, we're facing a climate crisis, we're facing environmental crisis, at the same time we're facing an affordability issues. And so where you spend your money is important, and where people spend their money to do, to align with their ethical beliefs or, you know, what they want to see for the future, for their kids, for their planet, it's really important. So I think I'm hopeful that the government will recognize that, make changes to Bill C-59, like Julianne said, and then also take a few more steps, add some regulation like we are seeing in Europe that gives a bit more specificity, have the Competition Bureau do guidance like we've seen from many other regulators across the world. And I think that would be really helpful. So I'm hopeful. I always come into this with hope.
It's a good way to live.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Thank you, everybody, for this great discussion. I think we know a lot more about it now than we did half an hour ago. So mission accomplished. Keldon Bester, Tanya Niemitz, Phil DeLuna, Julien Beaulieu. Merci à tous. À la prochaine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.